The business process leading today with EU plans to tackle energy crisis revealed, and this is a draft document that's been doing the rounds from the European Commission. So basically, it sounds like a mixture of a price cap and a mixture of a windfall tax is what's going to be proposed next week. They also have Eamon Ryan is in that story. They have an interview with him. He's saying this is bigger than the oil crisis in the 70s, and the supports for small and medium sized businesses will be needed. On another kind of note of this, and this is almost a bit kind of sinister, TikTok has warned the government, is the Offaly is, that its investment in Ireland could be in doubt unless the country's new policy on data centres aligns with the company's plans. The Sunday Independent is in similar territory, but they have an Ireland Thinks poll today, and according to that, only 7% say they're not worried about higher costs. More than a quarter of people in this poll say they have no savings. No savings. Half of people are struggling to pay their bills. Half are not. That's roughly the story. The Offaly and the Sunday Independent will be interesting to people because they have what they say will be the cost of living measures, which the Irish Times seemed to be suggesting yesterday could be announced next week. A doubling of the electricity credit, they're saying, so that would be to 400. Similar credit payments to businessmen, further fuel allowance lump sum payment, suspension of a range of government charges, and probable, quotes, further transport reductions. So that's the Independent. The Irish Mail on Sunday, 6 billion tax hold blow to energy relief hope. So a cabinet dossier on the loss of corporate receipts warns of major risks. So what all that is saying is that this money cannot be relied on in the future, this 6 billion we have sloshing around now. But I suppose people are thinking, well, we have it now and it's one-off measures we're looking for. So, I don't know if anyone's thinking too hard about the future at the moment. The Sunday Times have a story about the head of Cervical Check apologising for careless and hurtful comments she made about the women affected by false tests. And they also have as their off lead, and indeed it's the front page of the Sun and the Mirror, another desperately sad story of poor young Jack de Bromhead, 13, and as you heard on the news there, riding his pony in races on Rossbay Beach yesterday and killed. And the Sunday World has gang boss Stephen Saunders nabbed by UK cops in Heathrow Airport. Interpol alerted Gardaí he was staking out cash in transit plane. Right, and to discuss all those things and more, our panel this morning, Mary Minahan is acting features editor at the Irish Times. Dan O'Brien is chief economist with the IEEA and a columnist with the Business Post. Sarah Kelleher is the CEO of Lourdes Youth and Community Centre. And Johnny Fallon is a strategy director at Carr Communications. And we should say a former member of the Fianna Fáil National Executive. Right. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
I suppose what this looks like, Dan, to me, is that the COVID playbook is being resurrected again, and people want, we're in an era of massive government, massive handouts by the government to whatever crisis arises. And this is what's happening again here. If you look across all the papers, is it?
I don't think it'll be as comprehensive as that. You know, we're clearly seeing an extraordinary moment in the European energy market in particular. There's a global dimension to this, but there's a particular European dimension to it. And that will have an implication. I don't think the implications will be as big as COVID. You know, we shut everything down for months on end and government intervened hugely. I think there will be interventions, further interventions. There are all sorts of possible ideas, both at government level, national level, and at EU level. But I don't think it'll be to the scale of COVID.
But probably the right thing to do right now to just intervene and one-off or temporary payments to a lot of people.
There's certainly a case, given the size of these increases, that there will be people who simply will not be able to afford that. And it is right and proper that there would be an intervention to target it at those really in need. I would just say, let's not forget history. We go back to the last big shock in 1979, energy shock, when energy prices went crazy. Inflation went up. There was a global recession. Most countries bounced out of it pretty quickly. Ireland had a lost decade. We mishandled that energy shock.
What did we do?
We tried to compensate everybody for everything and spend our way out of it. We ended up with mass emigration, unemployment throughout the 80s into the 90s. We made a mistake there. Other countries did not have a lost decade in the 1980s. We did. So we need to be careful. I'm not saying there's not a case for targeted interventions, but we blew it in the 1979, early 1980s, and people suffered for a decade. Many people left the country. There was mass unemployment. We need to be careful that we don't make the same mistakes again.
Okay. Johnny, you've picked Daniel Murray, that interview in the Business Post with Eamon Ryan. The government won't be found wanting.
Yeah, and in this, Eamon Ryan talks about, you know, the measures that the government can introduce and that they're eager to tackle this. And, you know, he plays out his stall fairly well in it. But I think also within the interview, you can get that sense of where the difficulty comes for government and ministers in this. Because, you know, the short term, you know, you have people who are getting really scared right now. And when people get scared about these things, they think very much on an individual basis. And it becomes, you know, how am I going to heat my home this winter? And how am I going to pay the electricity bill? And the fear of that bill landing and maybe suddenly getting thousands of euro of a bill, not realising my electricity was going up or my gas usage was so high. That fear is very real for people. And it makes them check out of the bigger picture argument that's going on. Meanwhile, you've government trying to talk about bigger picture arguments, which is, as Dan says, things like European energy market, where we get our energy from, how we source it. The real things the government can control, if you like, to a degree, are things that are going to take years for them to actually implement to make for the better or change for the better.
And people don't have that.
The short-term measures, are really, really difficult.
Yeah. Now, Sarah Kelleher, I presume you work in the north inner city in Dublin. I presume people there aren't looking at the bigger picture and thinking about the long term right now.
No, because when you live in a situation of poverty, you never look at the bigger picture or you never even look at the future. It's all about today and surviving today. And that's one of the unfortunate features of poverty, because that can affect your whole life. Whereas for other people, even in something like education, you take the long view, you get your kids to school, you think about college. They're thinking about today because they're surviving. Yeah. And what's missing in this discussion, I mean, I agree absolutely with Dan when he said we need a targeted intervention. And that is really important, that it isn't universal.
Is 400 quid of an energy credit for everyone, would you be against that? So given that, according to that poll, which we'll come to in a minute, half the people are not struggling to pay their bills
I would
at the
be
moment,
against
half
it.
Are. Give 800 to the half, would you say?
Yeah, because there are the people who are already on welfare benefits, the government knows who they are. So you can target them easily. I get there's an administration problem with not using universal methodologies, but people who are on welfare, they are known to the government. They can be targeted. The fuel allowance can be increased. And that has to be the only way forward, because we have to show compassion for people in those situations.
How bad is it, Sarah, in the people you're dealing with at the moment? Like, are things substantially worse than they were for them a year ago, 2 years ago?
Absolutely. And, you know, children particularly now have a language that we didn't have growing up. And we would see children every day talking about anxiety, and how anxious they are about everything, whether or not even...
Small kids,
yeah, absolutely. Even though we might think, are they using the word inappropriately, maybe, but they're able to say things and describe their situation better than we ever could. And COVID gave them, leapfrogged all of us into something that we didn't ever expect. And in that situation, you had people stuck in their houses, not able to avail of services that were supporting them. And one of the best services we have in Ireland is the Vincent de Paul, who have come out with absolutely shocking figures. Over 500,000 people living in poverty. These are our people. These aren't some other people. This is our people in our country living in poverty. 200,000 children who are in forced deprivation. There's no child in this country who got themselves into poverty. It's forced, enforced deprivation. And 90,000 of those people have jobs.
What does enforced deprivation mean? Well, 200,000 children is a huge amount. Yeah,
it's a shocking amount.
What does that mean? What
means
a granular level?
It means
like
a child,
getting enough to eat?
Yeah, they mightn't, you know, there's a matrix for what that means, and I haven't got the list in front of me. But there, you know, any child needs to live in a situation where they feel safe and secure. Somebody, and I'm sorry if she's listening, had something on Twitter during the week which I thought said it all. They overheard this conversation on the Lewis. A mother was talking to her 6-year-old sitting opposite her. 6-year-old said, could we go to Tesco's to buy dinner? And the mother says, no, it's just we have to have toast again tonight. Granddad has given us money on Thursday. This is Monday. We have only 2 or 3 more days to go. Okay. That's where we're at. Now, is this this is not the country. I actually believe in politicians more than most people who think I do. This is not the country we designed 100 years ago, that our children, we need to keep naming them as our people. Because otherwise, what is happening, and I see it all the time, people think it's people over there, somebody else, it's not me. And now because the middle classes are struggling, I'm going to say myself, insofar as the rise and increase in fuel and so on, everything has gone up. Every single thing has gone up. That we think, somewhere along the line, we think the poor actually are used to being poor and it's not so bad for them. But that's not true at all. They live in relentless poverty. We all think, look, this is a phase. Dan is saying, like, we don't want to lose a decade. We hope it's not a decade. We think, well, there's light at the end of the tunnel somewhere. If you're living in poverty, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. There's a relentlessness of it.
Okay, Sarah. Mary Minahan.
Yeah, I think ministers are already dampening down expectations of what the government can deliver on September 27th when Budget 2023 will be announced. You know, you hear a lot of talk about a buoyant economy and a surplus, and there is a disconnect, as Sarah and Johnny have outlined, between that sort of talk and what is going on in people's homes. And we should probably mention the hospitality industry as well, which is just getting its head back up after COVID, and these huge energy bills are now dropping on the mat. So it's heralding an autumn and a winter of discontent. I think correctly in the budget, there will be targeted measures aimed at those on lowest incomes. There will be the normal budgetary measures that we get every year, the, you know, permanent tax and welfare changes, allocation of spending to education and so on. But we'll see a lot of these once-off rolled out measures. I think Senna Maloney and others in the Sunday Independent have outlined them. But I think for the government, the problem may be reaching the squeezed middle. I don't like that phrase, but fixing,
which Fine Gael are determined to do from their public utterances, you would think.
And also the Green Minister, Roderick O'Gorman, the Minister for Children, has said that the government wants to cut fees for parents by childcare fees for parents by 50% over the next
over two
budgets.
Yeah. Dan, do we need to change our definition of what a recession is? It's quite a technical definition. And we're back to macro and micro, aren't we? Like, the macro economy is roaring ahead, but there's a lot of people not living that dream.
Well, if you're not confused about what's going on in the economy, you haven't really been paying attention. I am really struggling. This is my business, and I am struggling to make sense of what's going on here. You know, you look at that dashboard of economic indicators, and usually you can get a sense of where things are going. It's gone haywire. So on the one hand, you look at the jobs market, like there's no unemployment, but jobs are booming. On the other hand, this inflation shock has caused a historic a crunch on incomes. People's incomes have really been affected by this. So on the one hand, you've got this fantastic jobs market. On the other hand, you've got people with less money, this sudden contraction thanks to inflation. Other things, you know, companies are investing, Irish companies, foreign companies are investing. At the same time, we have this incredible amount of uncertainty. Normally, when you have uncertainty, you don't get investment. So I'm really struggling to make sense of where we're going here and what's happening with the economy. So, you know, whether
is it inequality?
Inequality is always an aspect of any society economy. I don't think it's inequality that's
more,
causing
more
this.
More inequality than there used to be? Inequality getting inequality?
The measures, the various measures of inequality have shown Ireland is remarkably stable over a number of decades in terms of income spread. So, you know, we've got all sorts of things. We've got the pandemic and the after effects. We've got the oil shock, the energy shock, I should say, the broader energy shock. We've got war. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on out there, and it's just caused that dashboard of indicators to go haywire. And, you know, even people like myself, whose job it is to pore over this every day, I am really struggling to make sense of where the economy is
going. The fact that you're struggling makes me struggle as well. That's a worry. Listen, Mary, the poll in the Sunday Independent is probably a good snapshot, taking into account that, you know, a poll is what it is, and it's 1,000 people or so on a day saying what they say. But it does dig into all this, what people feel they're experiencing in terms of cost of living at the moment.
Yeah, and the big headline is huge concern over rising energy bills, and that's it in a nutshell, along with the fact that more than a quarter of people who responded to that poll have no savings. So, you know, the government is going to come out with, the figures are enormous, 6.7 billion budget, and then the separate cost of living package that might cost another 2 billion, and the once-off measures, as we've spoken about, that might try to help people somehow get through this very, very tough winter that's coming. So, you know, a lot of political creativity is required in terms of being creative and thinking about energy bills. I spotted an interesting piece in the Sunday Independent from Colin Murphy when he talks about wind and how we should be using wind as an energy source. He says the science is ready, but the infrastructure, logistics and planning regime are not. And he's got some really punchy quotes from the economist John Fitzgerald, from Connor Sweeney, who's an expert in wind energy in UCD. And so we're basically saying the planning and regulatory framework is not yet fit for purpose, but this is a way out of it, that a resource we could harness, but we're tripping ourselves up by our own failure to do so.
Okay. Just staying with the poll for a minute, Sarah, I thought one interesting little nugget buried in there is that in this poll, three quarters, roughly, I think 73% of people don't feel that politicians understand what people are going through. And it kind of has echoes of that line that Sinn Féin have been using for quite a while: the government doesn't get it.
Yeah, and you know, Kevin Cunningham in the Sunday Independent talks about rich TDs don't quite get the plight of others. And you see, and he makes an interesting point there where he says that there's no utility function that can inform political decisions, such as whether an investment in education or healthcare is preferable. So therefore, we must acknowledge that decisions made by TDs are unavoidably subjective. And that means that TDs make decisions about things they know or things that they have experience of, as opposed to using some other methodology to say, would we be better putting money into education or health? Which one, if it's an either or, which one is going to produce the result? And the plight of people on the lower end of the economic scale is therefore easier ignored because they don't vote. And at the end of the day, all governments are worried about the next election. Always. Every TD is worried about the next election. And if they don't vote, then it's easier to ignore them. Now, what Sinn Féin has done, and I can see it all around, is that they have targeted those people and they have brought them in. I mean, even at the last election, we carried out a voting campaign, which was to get people on the register. This isn't telling people how to vote. It's just, please vote. We got 600 new people on the register. The voting figures in the north of the city are very poor. So, you know, people, the apathy out there for people that I live and work, not I don't live there, but work around, is that they're all the usual. They're all the same. They don't understand us. No matter what we do, they'll do it. They'll vote that way anyway.
But Johnny, it sounds like that idea is taking, and the last few weeks probably didn't help, in fairness, and with the stories around Robert Troy and around Stephen Donnelly. It sounds like it's taking hold more than beyond those communities and beyond young people. If three quarters of people in a poll, which again is a snapshot of certain random people, have taken on this narrative that these guys don't get it.
Yeah, and I think the important word there is the narrative, you know, and that's what you have to fear in politics and government is the narrative. You know, there's a great book by Robert Shiller, Narrative Economics, where he talks about how all the big economic trends and all the big things that affect us globally and everything are actually based on a narrative that takes hold. And once that narrative starts, you can't. Like, on one level, I could say to you, the idea that the government is out of touch. In all the years I've been following politics, I can't ever remember a government that people said was in touch and that got people. And that anybody said, oh, the government gets us, understands us, and they get it. That just doesn't happen.
No, I've never heard that.
The problem is that when you hit a crisis point on that, there's a certain level that always exists. And then people go, well, they don't get us and they don't understand us. No one likes the government, but they're the best of this lot or that lot. And we've disagreements over here and over here. However, when you hit a crisis thing, like what's happening now with the likes of the energy crisis or what happened a little bit during COVID, these are a couple of crises, one after each other. And you're getting a narrative of these guys really don't understand us, and they're going, you know, to the next available thing. The narrative will continue even if you change government. That's what history tells us. So Sinn Féin are building on this. they will suffer from it in time, and they will get into government. I have no doubt in my mind that they will, because that narrative has grown. It's going to be almost impossible for this government, though, to push back on that now that it has been
okay.
The crisis.
So look, we know anything can happen between now and election and all that. Nothing's a foregone conclusion, but you think there's an unstoppable, inevitable story going on here that
there is,
has
yeah.
to be played out.
And it has to be played out since the last election, so because that, it was an expectation of people that it would happen. When it didn't happen, they're still pushing for it to see.
And some would argue that Sinn Féin didn't want it to happen at that point.
And it has worked out well for them.
Mary, Elaine Byrne is dealing with this as well in the Business Post. Property owning politicians facing a winter of discontent. She seems to be saying this story is only starting and that this is going to be a focus now for people.
That's right. She's saying there are two types of people in Ireland, those who own their home and those who do not. In a nutshell, this is what the messaging around the next general election is going to look like. And she's talking about how the focus on the property interests of politicians who happen to be in government, Troy and Donnelly, that serves to draw attention to their status as landlords, and then that them versus us or homeowners versus renters narrative, she says, will ratchet up a fair bit now when the Dáil resumes on September the 14th. And I think it's true that we probably don't need to rehash the fall of Troy and the trouble that Stephen Donnelly found himself in. But I think the visceral response to those stories points to this being about an issue rather than about individuals. And the issue, of course, is the lack of affordable housing, or indeed any housing, the pathetic number of rental properties available, the reported exodus of landlords from the market, all this at a time when third level students are arriving into the cities, not just Dublin, for the new college term, which we may get to. I think also part of it is a kind of a generational disconnect. If you look at the average age of TDs, it's late 40s. Robert Troy, a bit of an anomaly, he's only 40. And I dare say senators are older again. But, you know, people in that age bracket, if they didn't take the scenic route to parent, have children who are soon to venture out into the world. And they know, the people outside Leinster House, they know that the goal of being able, you know, to rent a flat that they would have done, as they would have done when they were young, their children won't be able to do that. They
so
won't
Mary,
be able to
way,
live independently.
So, Mary, the way you're talking here would lead a person to think, is there a feeling, and you're obviously talking to people in the political world all the time, is there a feeling that there is an earthquake developing here?
I think this is, as Elaine Byrne says, going to be a very easily understandable divide in Irish life that will be capitalised on by opposition politicians. Although Elaine does make the point there that Sinn Féin is the richest political party on the island of Ireland, and she says it has an estimated 50 properties. So, you know, it's a piece that's really worth reading, because TDs and senators will see a lot more digging now into their property interests, not just property.
And we should mention as well that there was a Sinn Féin TD who owned four properties and who did neglect as well to have one of them up to date with the RTB. Dan, does it sound as if you listen to all that, to Johnny and Mary especially, that like it's the economy stupid, it's the housing stupid. Is that going to be the big divisive issue, the big deciding issue in this country going ahead?
No, I don't think the economy. I think you see
like
that
if housing was fixed, would everything not be okay?
No,
I think that's the feeling people have that the housing thing is contributing to all the other issues.
It certainly is. But I think there's a general thing in the Western world, a rise of sort of anger and discontent, and it's not, you know, maybe there's an economic dimension to it, but it's not just that. There's something in the zeitgeist being angry.
I'd be angry if I was a young person these days, would you?
Absolutely, particularly if you were
I probably was when I was a young person, but you definitely would be now.
Like, when you and I were young people, it was the miserable 80s, you know? I immigrated straight out of college. Many people were unemployed. It was a tough time then. I'm not saying, you know, every generation has its challenges. But I'm just saying, when we rang in the new year on December 31st, 2019, there was a general election in the air. The opinion polls were showing that the two parties that had dominated politics for decades were going to still be the two big parties. Sinn Féin had had a terrible local and regional election a few months earlier. Nobody was predicting it was going to do well. They were even running fewer candidates because they thought they'd do so badly. What's changed? Something has radically changed in this decade, and we're only a quarter of the way through it. politics has changed. Look at the opinion poll today. Sinn Féin on 36%, the two civil war parties are a shadow of them of their former selves. Is that because...
Is it a new generation finding its voice, flexing its muscle, who feel they've been really hard done by this country?
Why did it happen so suddenly? I still struggle to explain, not only economics, but politics as well. Why did it suddenly happen that for decades, throughout the 80s, we still had Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael duopoly, when things were bad in the 1950s, things were appalling here as well. And then suddenly, only the past couple of years, something has changed. And it's you can't put it down to housing because we've had a housing problem.
Maybe it's
problem
effective
a while.
Leadership and effective politicians in Sinn Féin. What changed, Johnny?
I think I think Dan's spot on. They went into the 2020 election with Fianna Fáil recovering, are expected to be the biggest party by a long way. They had one terrible campaign, woeful campaign. There's no getting away from it from Fianna Fáil that allowed Sinn Féin back in. But in response to that woeful campaign, the two parties politically, when you talk about leadership and where young people who are annoyed at these issues start to look for where the answer is, the two big parties, if you like, took the absolutely unbelievable decision in their own historical terms of saying, we're going together. Meaning there is no alternative to Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. They have now become one. And if you want an alternative to that policy, Sinn Féin is the only viable alternative. The decision for the two of them in the last 2 years to coalesce, not the elections, not the results, it was that decision that ended the ability of the two of them to remain two big blocks of parties. And it forced people to into another party.
Excuse me. Was there an element as well of that? I suppose people were punch drunk for a while after the financial crisis and after all the fallout of that. But is there a generation coming of age as well that's suddenly all crystallising for them and they blame the political establishment for it and they feel they've been hobbled and now hobbled again by COVID and set back again and again in getting on with their lives?
I think what your feedback you would get certainly from the political parties is that is at the youth level, that young people are annoyed
You're
about
nodding
housing,
along,
annoyed
Sarah,
about those
yeah.
things and
yeah,
that's the
I don't
problem.
See it as sudden at all. Not at all, because the problem with housing, yes, it's been going on for quite a while. But people got fed up with that, younger people particularly. And
yeah, but I suppose Dan's talking about a new kind of anger and a new kind of reaction to things and maybe more energy in it.
And you have social media as well, and you mustn't forget that. You're going to universities now, and Sinn Féin are huge in universities amongst young people, which wasn't the case before. Huge, and I mean huge to like over 90% of young people feeling they want something different. And of course, they've no experience of what Sinn Féin would be like in power. So there's no negativity about, well, in the past you did this. It's all brand new and shiny. And, you know, so it's for me, it's not sudden. It's because, like I said earlier on, there's a sense that they're responding to the issues on the ground, and politicians in the main generally, obviously even locally, I think every politician probably tries to respond to what's going on in their local area, but this is across the country and they're now...
So it's a movement, Johnny, in the way that your old Fianna Fáil used to be a movement in the days of your involvement.
Sinn Féin, are very much built on that. They've got a good organisation now. They're still building it. They're not quite there yet, but they've still built it. But look, they have this wonderful opportunity in Sinn Féin now, and electorally that's the challenge for them. They must capitalise on it. They will want to go into government. They will suffer when in government, but they can take a step forward that will really allow them to become a force in politics. But I suppose realistically, I would say again, for young people, where is the alternative? Sinn Féin is the only alternative because all the parties have been bunched into one side of government now otherwise.
I think it would be a mistake though just to see it as a youth quake. I don't think it's going to be like that. I mean, I think I'm talking about the people in their late 40s, 50s
absolutely.
Who have kids in their
20s. Sinn Féin's numbers growing in all demographics and indeed across all income groups as well.
A lot of those people were caught by the financial crash of 2008 and now they're seeing their own kids suffering as well. So they're very discontented too.
There's a very short, concise email here. Brendan, what has changed is income inequality. Well, Dan would say that hasn't changed, but also the breakdown of the social contract. And even if it's the social contract hasn't just broken down, it's back to Johnny, your narrative. There's a narrative of a breakdown of a social contract. Okay, listen, I just do want to, before we go to a break, obviously the bigger picture on energy is a huge story across all the papers. Say it's been talked about all week and everything. Dan, the front page of the Business Post, in terms of we're all holding out for what Europe is going to do. Can you explain to us how the energy market works and how it could be fixed? Because, I think a lot of people were confused that gas went down 30% last week. We heard all about it going up 30% the week before. Went back down, basically. All those losses gone. But somehow there was this rolling jump in electricity, in gas and electricity bills announced. So I think people are wondering what's going on here.
Okay, so with the pandemic, a lot of things fell in price and energy demand fell, so prices went down. There wasn't a preparedness for the bounce back that came, and that led to energy prices going up. Now, energy prices are very volatile. People often forget now that around 2007, we had extremely high energy prices and they came down with the global recession. So energy prices fluctuate. And so the immediate thing globally was the effects of the pandemic. In Europe, there's a particular issue with gas. We came far too reliant on Russian gas. It's clear now that the Russians were manipulating the market as starting about this time last year in preparation for the invasion of Ukraine. And clearly since then, the gas market in Europe has gone completely nuts. So in the United States, gas market hasn't changed that much. It's higher, but not that much.
I gather gas is 10 times the price here than it is in America.
Exactly. Right.
Extraordinary.
And so because those markets, unlike oil, where oil gets shipped around the world, most gas goes through pipelines. Now, that's changing very rapidly. They're liquefying natural gas and putting it into shipping it around. Now, here's an area that, in my view, we made a big mistake on. We are entirely dependent on our gas on the UK. We could have built a LNG liquefied natural gas container storage facility to bring it in from other countries. Unfortunately, we didn't do that. And now we are entirely dependent on a country we have very bad relations with. And a new prime minister talking tough coming in tomorrow.
Just to say that we do have an all island gas network too, so it could be difficult for them to decide to punish one half of the island or
two-thirds
of the island.
I've spoken to people, there's some disagreement on this, okay, but it could be engineered so they could flow the gas into the north and not into the Republic. Now, there's disagreement on that, but it's certainly not. It's something that keeps me awake at night a bit.
Okay, so stupid question now, and you're usually good at answering these. Are our electricity prices currently, this so-called wholesale price of electricity, is that based on traders in a commodity gas market basically pricing things up and down based on sentiment and their thoughts about the future? And then we base the official electricity price on all of that?
Ultimately, it's a market-based system. What we pay. Now, it works in different ways in different countries. I just had
So the EU could fix this?
No government or EU can wish this away.
Prices so that, like, you know, we're all waiting to see what the European Commission are going to do next week.
So as the Business Post is reporting today, the base of this plan is that if you take something like nuclear, so nuclear is not related to gas. So the cost of generating nuclear energy, electricity, has not gone up. So the proposal is that you would cap those areas like renewables and nuclear that haven't gone up, and you could use that would be one way of helping to contain it. But the basic
problem...
So
they're not paying gas prices on all
on everything. But the basic problem is we have a massive... Yes, there's certainly a case for it, that we have a massive shortage of energy. And that has pushed prices up, and prices ultimately what we pay is based on what's going on in energy markets. And energy markets in Europe in particular
have gone
very badly wrong.
It sounds like you're not hopeful about there being any easy fix for this.
There's no easy fix. It could be. Like this, unlike in the 70s when the energy producers came together and said, right, we are jacking up prices permanently. Okay, that's not what's happened here. So it's possible that like 2007 when energy prices went very high that they will come back down again. So it's not like the 70s where they're jacked up and they will stay up forever. It is possible that if things go right, the problems in energy markets could unwind and energy prices could come back down.
And of course, one thing that would presumably do that is people using less energy. So the high prices could have that their own effect.
Could help.
Look, all right, I still don't feel I get it 100%, but I'm a little bit wiser. Sarah Kelleher, you were enjoying the pictures in the papers and online and everything of the revelers, as they get called in papers, when there's a picture of them at the electric picnic.
And, you know, if anybody has any fear of how the youth of Ireland are going to, you know, run the country in the years to come, I think anybody who can sustain 10 hours of rain yesterday has got some great courage and great ability to be, you know, go for it and stick with it. aren't they great?
Yeah, I suppose that is a determination, definitely. I think I would have, as a young person, again, you would have applied that determination to some things, but maybe not to everything. But there, yeah. Listen, if anyone woke up and heard that rain during the night there, you had to think of them. But apparently, I gather the sun is out down there now, so hopefully they'll have a nice last day. No sooner will the electric picnic end than we will have a new prime minister in the UK. And Mary, you and Sarah both picked Aoife Moore's piece in the Sunday Times. Britain's next big cheese, sharp, thick-skinned and overpowering, but focused a bit on our dealings with her and what they will be.
Yeah, I think it's just there's going to be so many trust puns now. The Sunday Indo has a piece from Sam McBride. The course of unionism is now trussed up in red tape. Sunday Business Post, Michael Brennan and Liz, they truss. And then Aoife Moore's piece about the big cheese, that's obviously a reference to Liz Truss's slightly bizarre address to a Tory party conference when she talked about the need for British people to eat their own food. There's a sense of inevitability about this, I think, that Sunak is not going to win. I think if he did, Ireland and Northern Ireland would probably have been largely ignored.
We have to let that go. Brexit happened, Sunak didn't win. These are two things that we clung on to even after they happened.
But and I think though she'll be an interventionist, won't she? I think Britain has a tradition, not a proud one, of lions led by donkeys. And the fact is, while relations between Dublin and London are at an all-time low almost, we actually have great common cause with the British people in the sense that their concerns are our concerns. If you listen to any radio phone in Britain, what are they worried about? They're worried about electricity bills, they're worried about childcare costs, they're worried about their health service, all the same things that we're worried about. They're in a very bad place economically. The British pound is at its lowest rate against the dollar in living memory. This woman who's coming in now, Liz Truss, I suppose we see her now as a caricature. She's this old-fashioned politician who's obsessed with things like mental arithmetic and hoping that her civil servants can answer questions on maths and so on. But to be serious, I think she does have the potential to be a wrecking ball in relations between Ireland and Britain, because her public pronouncements have been alarming.
But is there any chance that, and again, this is clinging to straws here now, or grasping at straws, is there any chance that she's speaking to, a small group of people at the moment who are Tory party members, and that she's speaking to an even smaller group of people who are the so-called ERG gang, and that maybe she pivots away from that once she gets the job?
Well, she has courted the ERG, that's that cabal of hardline Brexiteer MPs within the Tory party. But I presume they will want a reward for their support. So she will have to give them high positions in the British cabinet. You know, she herself is foreign secretary. She said the jury's out as to whether or not the French president, Emmanuel Macron, is friend or foe. You know, the old idea of British statecraft is totally gone.
Johnny, Mary mentions though Sam McBride's piece there. And Sam McBride does make the point that what could happen here is that the protocol is ended, but it's not really ended. That once you can say to the DUP, mm-hmm. okay, we've dealt with the protocol, but that in reality, if you do it creatively, nothing much might change. A bit of creative mm-hmm. ambiguity, as we always had.
And look at that. As you say, as we always had in Northern Ireland, the famous thing, even coming up to the Good Friday Agreement, the famous phrase of, the form of words. You know, we need a form of words, and we need a form of words that works for people and lets people save face and get around. These problems shouldn't be impossible for us. I think, for Liz Truss coming in, what you are getting here is somebody, there's a slight unpredictability because of the type of politician she is. If you look at her, this is someone who was protested along with her parents against Thatcher. She was a left-wing upbringing, has moved from the Lib Dem kind of profile over. So what you're getting really to me there
and,
is a politician.
And was a Remainer.
And was a Remainer. And this is somebody, she's a chameleon who really her aim and her vision in politics is for her. She is the product. Okay. She wants to remain in power.
So could this be helpful to us?
It could
then?
Be helpful or negative, depending on which way she handles it. Because it can be helpful because that person, if she looks at it and she is determined to have a long career and leave a mark, then she will change not just for the ERG and the groups that she needs to handle there, but she will see bigger picture stuff and know, I don't want to end up like Boris, gone in a couple of years because I keep flunking the things. I've got to get something right on the big side.
Could I just disagree with Johnny slightly?
Yeah.
Okay. With the Good Friday Agreement, it was about identities, things could be fudged. The really downside of this, and 5 years on, it frustrates me that this is not clear. Northern Ireland can only be in one market. It's either governed by EU laws or it's governed by British laws. It's a binary choice. And that makes everything much more difficult.
Are you going to have grace periods and things like
and
that?
And that's what's happened. So yeah. The grace periods, but are grace periods going to be indefinite? The EU doesn't want that. Mm. So the problem with this is that it's turned a binary decision into a test of strength, both between London and Brussels and between the two communities. Sam McBride's piece notes that in a recent opinion poll, 82% of unionist voters support the DUP in not going in. So this has become a really divisive issue.
I wonder if they could be given a way of climbing down the hill with everybody happy.
The reason this has gone on for five years
is because it is binary.
Yeah.
But Dan, it's because it's been allowed to become binary. You see, if you're in a negotiation, if people can't focus on positions, you can't move on. And that's what's happened. When you get them to come away from positions and focus on issues,
the issue is which market is Northern Ireland going to be in? Whose laws govern Northern Ireland?
Yeah. The issue is that Northern Ireland unionists feel abandoned. And they're afraid of their position being... They are expressing that through Brexit and the market.
Both things can be true, Johnny.
Both things can be true, but one can be solved by the other. There are other wins for unionists. Johnny feels like a man
who sent two people out of a room, both of them thinking that they got what they wanted.
That's the secret to it. You know, look, the unionists have something. There is a fear among the unionist community that has to be helped by the British government that they are not being abandoned. That doesn't mean
that has to be helped by us down here.
Why has somebody not come up with the answer over 5 years? Yeah. This idea of taking Northern Ireland out of the British market hit the negotiating table almost exactly 5 years ago. Yeah. Nobody has been able to square the circle because
binary choices are very difficult to square.
They have to admit the lie that it was Brexit. This issue is the same as it was before Brexit.
Yeah.
But they fooled the unions, to think that this was solvable. It was never solvable before Brexit. They lied to get Brexit through. And now they're stuck with the problem. And there is almost no binary solution. You know, there's no one solution. Yeah.
So they're stuck in a huge lie now that she has to double down on. They won't admit the lie.
They can't. Yeah. Boris was never going to admit the lie. Had they admitted the lie, then where would they be then? But you know, we were talking at the break. She's like a transformer. You know, one minute she's a lorry and the next minute she's a man, like a child's transformer. You know, and we don't know her. Nobody knows her. So we won't. Like, there was a great line there from a Chinese military general who says, "Know your enemy and know yourself, and in 100 battles you will not be in peril." But we don't know her if we see the British Prime Minister as an enemy, and we'd hope they wouldn't be. You know,
but for longevity, if she wants a long career, which I think she will do anything to have, she needs to solve the problems with Europe.
Wishful thinking, Mary, if your country is facing Armageddon, which you mentioned about them having the same concerns as us in Britain. They have them multiplied by 10, though. Like, everything feels like it's falling apart over there now.
Yeah.
Does she want to pick a trade war with Europe at the same time?
I think she wants to distract people with other matters. Okay. And what we do know about her is that she's the champion of the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. And what that is legislation introduced in Westminster, still has to go through the House of Lords. It hands to British ministers the power to tear up what is, you know, a negotiated internationally binding agreement between London and Brussels, created to avoid a hard border here on the island of Ireland. So this is a festering sore that isn't going to heal up anytime soon. You know, she has changed position. And that's legitimate. People are, you know, you're allowed to differ from what you were as a student and have a different political outlook. But she may have a fresh approach when she comes in. I think the Taoiseach, the current Taoiseach Micheál Martin, has been making soothing sounds about, you know, the need for a fresh approach. And there is an imperative for something to happen quickly because, of course, for political geeks, the big date now in the political calendar is mid-December when we have the rotating Taoiseach thing and Leo Varadkar comes back into the Taoiseach's position for the second time. So It'll be very interesting to see the relationship there. Of course, to be light about it, she can't even pronounce the word Taoiseach. She says Taoiseach. So
know,
there's
yeah,
a, there's a
that,
lot
that
to
can,
learn.
That
you
can
know?
Be silly kind of stuff as well. Yeah. You know, that kind. I like it, it. Aoife Moore does say in her piece that Liz Truss is looking for a meeting with Micheál Martin
yeah.
very quickly, which,
yeah,
you,
which
you,
I think is wise.
Think is, yeah, and could be a positive thing. Sarah, I just want to take a quick bite from you on something slightly different here, which is Christina Lamb's piece in the Sunday Times. Will you just tell us about women turning Taliban bullets into jewellery?
Oh, yeah, it's a lovely story in a dire situation where women have set up this network of women's groups where they are. And one of the things they're doing is teaching women all sorts of skills and crafts, because for some of them, their education is finished, their school, their career is over, they can't work. And one of the things they're doing is using Taliban's bullets and turning them into jewellery. And as she said, men are killing each other with these, but women are turning them into art.
Yeah.
And never was it so, you know.
So, and one thing is as well, we must not forget them. Remember how exercised we all were at the time about those women and their potential future, and we must not forget them. One texter says, French officials refer to Liz Truss as Boris Johnson without the jokes. And Kevin says, you'd all have egg in your faces if Richie wins. Kevin, if Richie Sunak wins, I'll eat not my hat, I'll eat one of Michael Flatley's hats from that film. I'll eat it live on the air here. Listen, before we go, Mary, you picked out a piece there about Mikhail Gorbachev and his funeral this week. But you were there when all this was going on.
I'm not quite at that time, but in the 90s, yeah, this piece is Vincent Boland in the Business Post. He's a lovely, succinct piece about Gorbachev not possessing the soul-crushing cynicism and amorality of his predecessors. Yeah, I was in Russia teaching English in the 90s with lots of little Muscovites running around talking like me, if you can imagine that. But that was Yeltsin's time. But I found the people there, there were lots of Irish out there actually making hay at that time. Now, not all just earning a few rubles teaching English like myself, but what it was like then was they still had that socialist thing where you could go to see a world-class ballet for cheapest chips, but people were really, really struggling. The ground was shifting underneath their feet as they were getting used to capitalism. Yeah. And what I noticed about the Russians that I encountered, they literally didn't waste a thing. When they were eating, they would suck the marrow out of bones. Like, they actually did that. The amount of food waste that went out of their house was minimal compared to the way we lived. And they weren't doing it because they were great environmentalists. They were doing it because they were poor and they had to. So personally, I felt very sentimental at Gorbachev's death. I think if you think back to his prime, you know, in the 80s, the Cold War was drawing to a close. But really, the threat of nuclear bombs and nuclear war still dominated our consciousness. And I think reflecting on that can give us some insight into the kind of helpless dread that young people feel today when thinking about the war in Ukraine and damaged environment. You know, this was a time when terms like glasnost and perestroika were on the news every night. So we remember him affectionately. We always pictured him with his
heady
wife.
Heady times, weren't they? Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, everyone. Listen, I know you all wanted to mention Professor Aoife Foley, who was on with us here yesterday and who's Mark Tye has a piece with today about not turning back clocks and various other measures. Send the kids to school at 9:30, get them home at 3:00. We don't have time to get to her, but just to acknowledge that she certainly seems to have made an impact with her suggestions. So thank you very much, Mary Minahan. Thank you, Dan O'Brien, Sarah Kelleher and Johnny Fallon.